okay?
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Today starts a very exciting time for Franchise Today, as our Legal Eagle franchise series will start today and run for the next 4 weeks. The focus of this series will be on legal issues within franchising, and thanks to franchise industry executive Joe Caruso, we have some of the finest legal minds in franchising as our expert guests throughout this series. Joe helped produce the Legal Eagle franchise series and has been a great coach and resource in franchise best practices, both for Franchise Today and for me at Franchise Essentials. This week, my guest is Michael Webster, franchise attorney and chairperson of Strategic Committee at the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Next week, the series continues with Lane Fisher as my guest. Lane, as many know, is a partner at Fisher Zucker and a member of the International Franchise Association Board of Directors. He and I will discuss financial performance representations and how to use them effectively. Then the following week, I'll be joined by Warren Lee Lewis, a partner in franchising and licensing at Ackerman Centerfeet. Just recently on Franchise Today, I spoke about Warren's great publication, The Franchise Seller's Handbook. Well, Warren and I will refer to his handbook as we discuss franchise sales best practices, including permitted and prohibited franchise sales activities. Then the series wraps up with Leslie Curran, franchise attorney at Plave Cook, as my final guest in the series. Leslie and I will discuss the pros and cons of using franchise brokers while mitigating risk. As well, Leslie will provide updates on the IFA Legal Symposium and provide us with some insights on the Women's Franchise Network. So make plans for joining us on Franchise Today every Thursday right into the Memorial Day weekend for the Legal Eagle franchise series. Last week, my guest was Franet's Blair Nickel. Blair and I explored the world of franchise brokerage and discussed current franchise sales challenges, doing business with franchise brokers, ethics and compliance within franchising, and much more. It was a very enlightening show as we had a record number of live listeners, and the same was true of individuals listening on demand over this past weekend. And just like all Franchise Today segments, including this one after the show, last week's show is always available on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. As many know, we've been working on a new internet radio concept, Franchise News Radio. I'm happy to announce its debut on Wednesday, June 2nd. It'll start out as a 15 to 20 minute weekly radio show that will touch upon franchise news that's been shared through various channels, including press releases and within social media. Now, here's the twist. It's that we'll be providing some opinion and input on the news. So, if you're releasing any news, please be sure it's accurate. Again, Franchise News Radio will premiere on Wednesday, June 2nd. Look for more details on Twitter at Fran News Radio. After my responses to what I believe were irresponsible comments by Fayez Karim on the LinkedIn Franchise Professionals Group, the discussion continued well into this week with some really great responses and varied opinions. I highly recommend a visit to the LinkedIn Franchise Professional Group. Check out the discussion and share your comments and opinions as well. Maybe collectively, we can take one more step towards squashing the illicit efforts of so-called franchise professionals whose very practices harm the integrity of franchising. Hey, I find no fault in the posting of the discussion by Kenneth Zweibel, but the sheer audacity of Mr. Karim really gets my goat. So, enough said, let's move on. My guest today is Michael Webster. Michael's an attorney, an academic, and businessman. He obtained his Ph.D. in choice theory from the University of Waterloo in 1988, and his external examiner was A.K. Sen, who is the Nobel Prize winner in economics. His J.D. in law is from the University of Toronto in 1994. Michael's commercial litigation practice is limited to representing franchisees, their associations, and dealers. He's a member of the Upper Canada Law Society. I love this. He says he'll pay a dollar to anyone who can satisfactorily explain why Ontario is Upper Canada. He was a member of the AAFD, which, as we know, is the American Association of Franchisees and Dealers, and was the supporting member of the year in 2007, member of the year in 2008, and a proud supporter of the Fair Franchising Standards Committee. Currently, Michael is chairperson of the Strategic Committee at the new International Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Michael is dedicated to providing small business operators with the benefits of online network economics. Michael, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.
You know, first, I'd like to give you credit for being part of the inspiration that led to this legal series. It was actually the result of one of your marathon Saturday morning telephone conversations with Joe Caruso, after which Joe informed me of the conversation and recommended to both you and I that you should be a guest on Franchise Today. From there, the concept for the Legal Franchise series evolved. So I appreciate your inspiration, and thank you very much.
Well, Joe and I have our old, I'll call it friendly adversaries. We started off on talking about franchising almost 5 or 6 years ago on now a defunct franchise chat board. And as you know, Joe takes no prisoners when he believes he has the correct view. So we had a lot of spirited debates on that franchise chat board. You know, he convinced me of some things, and I think I convinced him of some things, too.
Yeah, it's a good thing that we all have free long distance, because I know my conversations with Joe at times are quite lengthy, as I know yours are with him as well.
That's correct.
So tell me, in your opinion, why is Ontario Upper Canada?
I know the answer, but if I tell the answer, then I'll have to pay a dollar to everybody who hears. But I could now revoke the bet. No, I'll not tell you that. I'll let people continue to guess, because I think it's a great demonstration of how relationships change over time. And my bet's still on
for a while, and there is a an escalation of costs and cost of living, so that dollar probably has to be increased to $2 or $3, don't you think?
It depends on what I pay it in. I should say I offer to pay a loonie, whether it's of what value that may have in someone else's currency, I won't be able to say. Suppose right now you are in Greece, you probably would value that loonie highly.
Funny. You know, as most within franchising are aware, you're quite knowledgeable about independent franchise associations. So getting down to the topic of discussion today, please explain what you feel is an independent franchise association's role in franchising relationships.
Thanks, Paul. Well, sure. The first thing to understand is that many litigation groups call themselves independent franchisee associations, but they're not. They're just litigation groups. There are probably 100 to 300 independent franchisee association groups listed in the FDDs of franchisors. And the purpose, to understand why an independent franchise association has to exist in any reasonably sophisticated large system, 150 units up, you have to go to the basic premise of franchising. The basic premise of franchising is that your local operators are better experts at implementing and using the franchisor's trademarks and other tools than the franchisor could hire, right? If they could hire someone better than the local operator, they would do so. But then they would be a company and not a franchise. So the very existence of a franchise is premised on the existence of local operators who are experts. As experts, they need an association to gather together, to they need something to be able to communicate. They need to be able to get benefits and services that the franchisor cannot give them, either for legal reasons, for competence reasons, or just doesn't want to. They need to pass around their best practices, and occasionally they need as a group to solve some disputes between them and the franchisor. But you have to start with the premise that your franchise operators are local experts, and as any experts will, they'll form an association for their mutual advantage. So that's the basic reason that you have to have an independent franchisee association. Now, when I was at the ABA forum up in Toronto, Harris Chernow and Richard Schmidt gave a talk about independent franchisee associations. And you could tell that the audience basically thought that an independent franchisee association was just code for a litigation group. They did not understand the fundamental economics of franchising requires that independent franchisee association.
Sure.
Now, how the form, the corporate form of that independent franchisee association is all, there's many different forms it could take. But you need an association to provide minimally to provide a good alternative communication channel between the franchisor and franchisees. If you've bought a franchise and you think of yourself as a local expert, you are not going to accept immediately any directive from the franchisor as to how to run that part of your business that you think is yours. I mean, McDonald's has this problem, even though they're a terrific organization. But they understand, that they're herding cats a lot of the time. Now, if one of the best-run franchise systems understands that they have to communicate and collaborate with their franchisees and have a lot of channels for doing so, then any franchise system should realize the value of a good independent franchisee association to at least provide a clear communication channel.
Right, and you brought up a good point of being able to provide support that the franchisor is not capable of, which a lot of times franchisors don't want to admit to not having all the answers or being able to provide the support. And putting aside that a lot of them believe that these independent franchise associations are for the sole purpose of litigation, the support issue and their lack of expertise in areas that the franchisees need help at the local level is probably another reason why a lot of franchisors, especially upstart franchisors, aren't really too keen on independent franchise associations.
Yeah, that's right. And then, let me just give an example of the type of support that a franchisor will give in various degrees. And that's the critical site selection at the beginning. Well, if you read an FDD, most of the site selections say the same sort of bland thing, and it basically amounts to, we might help you, we might not, but we have to approve your site. Well, and, the operator probably has no idea about the sophisticated tools that are available larger organizations, and so knows very little about the techniques of site selection.
Right.
And that's you know, that's something that a franchisee association could easily provide out to its members. It's a it would be a benefit of, you know, joining the association. You know, the association could very well hire two or three experts in site selection and lease negotiation and make those experts available to their members. That's something that would help the franchisor. It's a service that the franchisor is unlikely to get into for most systems. And for startup systems especially, they probably don't have the expertise in-house anyways.
Right. So there seems to be some confusion even within the franchise community. So maybe we can clear something once and for all. How are independent franchise associations different than franchise advisory councils?
There's a lot of differences. Remember, franchisee associations is designed to provide communication, to educate its members, to provide its members with benefits, and to occasionally be advocates. They are also usually elected. There's a separate board of directors. They have their own corporate vehicle. And except for rare occasions, their relationship with the franchisor is not a contractual relationship. That is, you know, there's no separate contract between the independent association and the franchisor. And the focus of the Independent Franchisee Association is on those four channels. A Franchise Advisory Council is usually, largely, a hand-picked group of franchisees that the franchisor feels comfortable with bouncing ideas off of. You're on the Franchise Advisory Council because of a high comfort level between you and the a franchisor. That's good and it's bad. You know, it's good because, you know, franchisor can bounce some ideas off. He knows he's going to get support from the council. It's bad, though, because nobody's going to say raise harsh issues about the idea. And you're probably going to, you're just going to run into what we call an echo effect. Nobody's going to seriously criticize your ideas. And that's why you need, you know, there's the minimal role for your association to come in there, listen to you intently and understand what you're saying and tell you just as, you know, candidly as possible what they think the membership will react to your message and how you can jointly fashion a different message or a different initiative. But
sure.
the reason they're independent is they're independent. They're not picked.
Right.
The franchisor doesn't have control over them. But that's a good thing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so basically, you know, that does clear the air between the difference between them. Well, you know, you brought up a good word, you know, fashioned. How can the relationship be fashioned between the two so they, in essence, play well together?
Well, I think, again, this, you know, a lot of it is going to depend upon personalities, but there are some very, you know, straightforward principles of communication. Communication, I think, these days is actually harder and not easier because it used to be, even, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you would feel your primary, if you had a problem, your primary way of communicating would be with the telephone. You'd pick it up and say, look, A, B, and C. Now the primary way is shooting off an email. And emails are just terrible devices to try and have any sort of sophisticated back and forth the telephone isn't the greatest either. But so, you know, when you talk about fashioning those communication channels so that people can really understand what it is that the other side's up to, it takes a lot of work. And I actually think it takes some training. Some people are very good at it. Some people need to be trained in it. In our last newsletter, I had a link to some people, Mediation Works, that actually has a really interesting training program on dealing with difficult people or difficult situations. Sometimes that's what's needed. Sometimes it's, you know, just as minimal as establishing protocols. When do we use the telephone? When do we use email? When do we talk in public? When do we talk in private? You know, people say a lot of things in emails or on a blog or on a social media site that they would never say in person if that person was in front of them. They would never say that. It would never be that rude.
Absolutely. Don't you just cringe when they want to use text messaging for business purposes?
That just is, I don't understand that, but that seems, you know, there's a lot of things about social media I don't quite understand. But, yeah, sure, that, I think there's, yes, I think we have benefited from, you know, more informal communication channels, but we've also lost a lot, too. And, you know, I think it's easier to misunderstand what someone's saying with a lot of these social media communication channels. And I also think franchisees as a group have to understand, you know, just because something is in the franchisor's interest doesn't mean that it's not in their interest also. But you know, they have to work on that. So that is the ongoing project for any independent franchisee association, is maintaining those clear communication channels.
Sure, there's a lot of perceptions. I know one that I often hear is that many believe franchise advisory council positions are actually positions of royalty, where they feel members of the council just show up at meetings with no ideas or thoughts on how to improve the franchise system. And a lot of them think it's just a way to get out of town and get together with a couple of not even like minds, because like you said, a lot of times they're hand-picked individuals that the franchisor are comfortable with. So, you know, with all that in mind, you know, what should be important components of Franchise Advisory Council bylaws to ensure this doesn't happen? And really, I guess it comes down to what should be the true mission of a Franchise Advisory Council?
You know, I don't have a lot of views about Franchise Advisory Councils. My suspicion is that, you know, all of them are very different, and since they seem largely to be a product of the franchisor, you know, I don't think I have anything to say as a franchisee advocate on that. I think that, of course, the Franchise Advisory Committee can exist very well with the, you know, with an independent franchisee association. I think you could be, you know, members of both. I don't see any inherent problem in that. I just think that my sense is that these advisory councils are much more informal sounding boards. There's less responsibility associated with them. I think you're probably right. It's more of a patronage appointment. And I think the critical difference there is, you know, you're getting appointed by the franchisor as opposed to it being selected by, you know, the operators. But there's no, you know, they just do different things. I don't think, once a franchise system gets much over, I would say even 80 or 90 units, it's pretty hard for, you know, a hand-picked group of people to provide the necessary communication channel to the franchisor. They're just not going to tell them things that he or she doesn't want to hear.
Sure.
Now that's human.
Well,
let's
turn back to independent franchisee associations for a moment. You know, what should be the important components of their bylaws and, of course, leading into what should be their true mission?
Yeah, in their bylaws, you know, they have to remember that they are not a social club, but they have a business purpose. So their bylaws have to address things like successors. What happens when, you know, the president is unavailable? What happens when the treasurer is unavailable to sign checks? Because generally these things are going to be fairly small. Look, even the IFA, how many paid staff members does it have? Maybe 30, 35?
Something like that.
Yeah. So, you know, in the scheme of things, that's a pretty small business.
Right.
That's a very important thing because practically people are going to be out of the loop and the association has to do its business. The association also has to turn to the relationship between, you know, the paid executive director and a paid legal counsel, if they have one. That's a delicate balance because you have someone as the executive director who's largely in charge of providing and obtaining member benefit programs. He or she is paid. He or she will be running the convention. And then you'll have a volunteer board. And volunteer boards are notorious for thinking that, you know, they know more about how to do anything than the people that they've hired. So your bylaws have to address, I will call those jurisdictional issues. Once the budget, for example, is passed, you want to give your executive directors the maximum flexibility within the budget to accomplish his or her job. The last thing that you want is, you know, bylaws that require tremendous oversight by a volunteer board of your paid executive. That would make no sense.
Right.
You know, the bylaws have to be drafted in mind with that, you know, tension of you have a volunteer board and you have a paid executive. Now, there are some associations like DDIFO, which has a more professional board, and so their bylaws necessarily would be different. But we have at the IFADA a model set of bylaws that we'll give out to people or to their attorneys to let them tweak it. But this has been something that we found that has worked. The other thing...
Certainly a very formal structure,
yes,
which obviously is something that needs to be seriously considered, especially as individuals and franchisees think they could just form an independent franchisee association just for the sole purpose of litigation. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that from what you're saying and what I'm hearing.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it, and, you know, people will form, it doesn't, you know, people do form groups for litigation to solve problems that they think can only be solved by an interpretation of the contract and franchise laws. That's right, I understand that. The problem, though, is that once those legal solutions have been arrived at, many times there's still need for that independent franchisee association. It would actually be in the attorney's interest that that group continue as in an economic way It would be in the franchisor's interest for that group to maintain communications, but the group simply doesn't know how to do it, and they go their separate way. This, you know, happens over and over again, and I don't think that that waste of social capital, as it were, is a very good thing for healthy franchise systems.
Sure, absolutely, I agree. Well, you know, you talked about disputes and litigation, and as we know, these type of things are very costly and very time-consuming, and certainly takes a lot of focus away from day-to-day business. What are your thoughts on alternative dispute resolution?
I'm a huge fan of mediation. I'm a huge fan of having a well-thought-out dispute resolution process that both the franchisor and Independent Franchisee Association work together on as a an alternative to either arbitration or litigation. You're in a relationship. It's an easy call. Is this time to terminate the relationship? If so, let's go to court, let's go to arbitration. Or is this something that we have to work upon as business operators together?
Mm-hmm.
If it's something you've got to work on together, then you have to have some formal structure, some sort of formal mediation structure to help you get to a good resolution to your problem. And I just wrote about this briefly about Cavell ice cream. As you remember, in the 90s, they had a huge legal battle because Cavell was felt that it was failing, felt that they had to put in ice cream into grocery stores, which were in the arguably in the franchisees' protected territories.
Right.
Now, an economic problem, business problem. Oh, and then and they wanted to then charge the franchisee for, I'll call it the grocery route of, I think it was $30,000 to $40,000. Okay, now, there's an economic problem that gets translated into a contractual problem, a problem that when the contracts were drafted, they could have not possibly foreseen this business problem. They could have seen the outlines of it. But these people went to court. One group of franchisees lost, the other group won, depending on what the contract said. But who, you know, what happened to Carvel? What happened to this business plan? Did it work? Could it have been, you know, could had there been a strong association? That you can see obviously how you'd want to do this. You'd say, well, let's try it out in these centers here beforehand. We'll, if need be, we'll get a mediator to help us establish what we think the benchmarks of good success, mediocre success, and utter failure are.
Mm-hmm.
Let's agree with those and then let's go see if it works, right?
Well,
just because some judge tells you you have the legal power to make a poor business decision doesn't mean that you ought to go ahead and do it, right? I have the legal power to climb my trees in the nude. I'm not going to do it. That's not a good idea.
Not a good vision either.
No, I'm just thinking of that too.
I'm sure Mr. Carvel didn't think of these legal issues when he was on TV and the radio promoting Thinny Thin and Wally the Carvel Whale. That's for sure.
Right. That's for sure. And you know, you have, you know, it raises one of my other pet peeves about people who sell franchises as proven systems. There are no proven systems. There are only systems that have proved themselves in the past and are trying to adapt to new conditions. So Some of them are going to adapt well. Some of them are going to fail. And, you know, for Carvel, for their system to implode without even having the chance through a formal mediation process to solve their business problem is, of course, you know, the very definition of lose-lose.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you know, yeah. In doing some research for this legal series and specifically for today's segment, I was made aware, okay, somewhat aware, of the Arbitration Freedom Act.
Right.
Could you explain this and its importance in alternative dispute resolution?
Yeah. What will happen is that if the act goes forward and you have a mandatory arbitration clause in your franchise agreement, basically that clause will be of no effect, so that when there is a dispute, when a dispute does arise, you will have the choice of either going through to mediation, arbitration, or litigation. You know, in franchising, I think the problem with arbitration these days is that it's too much like a court. It's too expensive. It's too long. And too unsatisfactory. I think that's the view from many participants. I don't think this is my, you know, my own personal view is that the Arbitration Act is not going to significantly change what's wrong with the legal handling of franchise disputes.
Right.
I think that now Peter Silverman, who gave a great, he and Michael K. Lewis gave a great talk at the ABA Forum in Toronto on mediation and franchising. And Peter made, a really good point that franchisors should really be adopting a sophisticated mediation because of the way the FDD requirements are right now, is if you resolve something in mediation, you don't have to report it under item 3.
Interesting.
Yeah. So
very interesting.
And that's I think a huge incentive to to use these tools. Peter's actually going to be at our conference in Indianapolis presenting to us his vision of how we can establish some best practices in franchise relationships and dispute resolutions. And, you know, he's a, not only is he a businessman, he's been a mediator and arbitrator and trial lawyer for 20, 25 years. And his presentation with Michael Lewis was judged this year one of the best. They replayed it, did a teleseminar on it. So we're pretty excited to have him because I think franchisors, they're coming to the realization that both arbitration and litigation, except for those cases of clear-cut termination,
mm-hmm.
just don't give them what they want. Right? They want a business solution.
Having run a couple of franchisors myself, I've been involved in some arbitration, and I really wasn't too keen on the way things ran and the way they turned out. And I guess it must have been about 7 or 8 different times I've been through various stages of arbitration, and found a lot of time that the arbitrator themselves were very close-minded on some things, were very already judgmental into what the side or already prejudging what side they were going to go towards. I found there was a big education process to get them to know what the basis of the franchise relationship is, or even what franchise relationships are. And it was very difficult I found. I mean, is that typical with arbitration? Because I know not all arbitrators are attorneys. I know a couple that we had were just, you know, businessmen that had no clue what franchising was about.
I think you're making a very good point that in, you know, if you're before an arbitrator as a franchise, in a franchise dispute, they don't understand that there's, you know, the one person that isn't there is the franchise network, right? And that this decision impacts upon that. I don't think that they're sufficiently, not all of them, of course, but I would say even an attorney may not be sufficiently aware of the sort of the economics of networking that underlies this particular system. And I think you're absolutely right, the amount of education that you would have to time and spent on doing that nullifies the whole process.
Not to mention their willingness, the arbitrator's willingness, even to be educated.
Yes, I agree with that. And that's why I think, you know, mediation as a process works significantly better, because it can be over time. Nothing has to be decided today. It's always nice if something is, but, you know, people can walk away from the deal, think about ways of making it better, and you can always get things out of mediation that you could never get out of an arbitration or litigation. I mean, fundamentally, you go to court, so somebody gets money. Somebody pays some money to another person. Well, you know, 95% of business relationships don't end that way. Right? There's lots more going on. You know, I could provide you with some services on a discounted but fixed amount of time. There's a whole bunch of things that we could do in mediation, primarily just understand each other's problem.
And more often than not, it's probably just a great way to open up communications.
Yeah, that's why I would have everybody in an independent franchise, on the board of an independent franchisee association, take some a modern negotiation classes from Harvard or from Northwestern or any one of the, you know, hundreds of providers of that type of service. Primarily as a way of learning better communication tools. How can you really put yourself in the shoes of that other person without necessarily adopting their views? That's the biggest trick, right? You want to understand why that person says the things they do without necessarily agreeing with it. And I think
that's a good point.
You know, that will solve a lot of your communication problems, because you understand why this person's saying what they're doing. You don't agree with it, but you don't have to. Right? You can say, okay, I see that point of view, but I don't have to agree with that.
I have found in the times where we've used mediation, even though we thought, you know, we had a good open line of communications, that when we actually sat down in mediation, we uncovered the fact that we weren't that good. We weren't that good at listening, and we weren't that good at communicating. And there was this wall that was put up that seemed to be broken down during the course of mediation. And I know it worked out far better results in mediation than it did in arbitration, and that was even in the cases where we won in arbitration. I didn't walk away from there very happy. Certainly the lines of communication being open and sharing, you know, it's kind of like, you know, do I go for divorce or do I go to counseling? And a lot of times if you're in counseling, it's opening up the lines of communications, and people say, well, I didn't realize that, and you did this. Well, I didn't understand that bothered you, and you know, a lot of times it's an extremely emotional situation. And I think, personally, that even stems back to how the franchisor operates their business. I know in some circumstances that I've seen where a franchisee, let's say, is behind in royalties, and someone tells the operations manager, hey, the next time you're talking with the franchisee, ask him about his royalty payments. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, here operations is to provide support, keep that lines of communications opening. The second he mentions a royalty payment, that line of communications now has shut, because the next time that operations manager calls up, that franchisee is going to say, God, I really would like to talk to him. I do have some questions about some training or something that I might be doing wrong here, but I don't want to get into a conversation with him about my past due royalties. I'd rather talk to, you know, somebody else about that. And it immediately eliminates that very, very important line of communication, which, of course, when that communication stops and the radio silence starts, it's definitely heading down a road of disaster.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Paul, because then you can see as soon as the two sides stop speaking, they start thinking about what that other side might be saying. You know, and they're not saying anything like that, but because, as you say, you got radio silence, it's just too easy for people to all of a sudden adopt fairly antagonistic views. And, what once was a small problem, an operator's problem, maybe they're doing something wrong, and the failure of the payment of the royalty reflects some operational problems. Now nobody's going to ever talk about it. So
sure,
I think you're right.
Absolutely.
On that.
And then and then what usually happens, and I've been down this road on both sides of the fence, it's very easy to stick your head in the sand and say, okay, I'm going to continue running my business and not worrying about what's going on around me. And as I tell people, as they put their head in the sand, is that your most vulnerable asset is is sticking for all the world to see. And
I've written about that
time and again. I continue to post it on my site about the fear and consequences of failure. And I think because I succeeded tremendously as a multi-unit franchisee and failed almost catastrophically as well. So I've been on the franchisor and franchisee side, so I've seen it. But I think in that case, it was when the communications broke down is when the problems really start to escalate totally out of control.
Yeah, and, you know, to bring it back to the man who's put us together, Joe Caruso. Joe has suggested, and I think he's on to something here, is that, you know, an independent franchisee association could very well provide, you know, that sort of early warning to the operators that their operations are in trouble, and without it being the same type of, without that necessarily generating the antagonistic relationship that you have when, as you say, someone from operation phones up and asks about the royalty payment. I think Joe's idea is that if the franchisee association were to aggregate a bunch of financials from the from its members, you know, you could give out to your own members sort of reports saying, well, if you're here on the line, this is what's going to happen to you in 6 months. So I don't know which one of you are below this line, but here's the things that you might want to think about now.
Even though franchise agreements, a lot of franchise agreements require financial information to be submitted to the corporate office. Either it's one of the least followed rules of the franchise agreement that often than not more often than not is not adhered to, and it's not pressed on the franchisor side. And then when they do submit it, a lot of times on the franchisor side, a lot of times they don't even know what they're looking at, and how to explain it back and forth. And so, you know, that's a problem too. And I think also, and this has more to do with the philosophy of the franchisor from the get-go, is do they truly feel that a franchise relationship should be interdependent as opposed to treating it almost like an employer-employee relationship, which, as we know, a lot of franchisors tend to do. And then, of course, there's a lot of resentment. And again, it all circles back to the emotional side of it. And when the emotions start to rise, that's when the communications break down.
Yeah, it's a very good point about the employee-employer relationships. You know, franchisees as corporate types of entities have only been around for, 50 years, or the sophisticated systems have really only been around for 50 years, with some exceptions in the hotel industry. But, you know, we have had hierarchical corporations like the Army and Church almost forever. So,
right.
You know, it's just natural. And nothing bothers me more than to hear a franchisee refer to the franchisor as corporate or head office. They're
mm-hmm.
not corporate or head office. They're not your employer. They can't be your employer. And stop ignoring your own responsibilities to the system by talking about corporate or head office. By their design, franchisors have much smaller levels of administration than a firm would delivering the same goods and services.
Sure, absolutely.
You know,
and you bring up a good point of franchisees' own responsibilities. I think more often than not, especially on the lower level, in lower investment level franchises, where they feel, okay, I've bought this, now I can sit back and the business will come my way. I mean, there has to be some responsibility on their part as well.
Absolutely. The franchise system works because you have what economists call, you know, network effects. And a network effect is very easy to describe. A telephone's a network because as more people get on the telephone system, the possibility of connection, that is pairwise conversations, grows higher. So,
right.
And that's where the value is. And a lot of, especially as you say with the, I'll say, new or startup or smaller schemes, you know, the franchise, no one's telling the franchisee, look, you've got to contribute to the network. That's the point of this. That's why you have an independent association, too, to, you know, remind the franchisees as a group what their
right.
group responsibility is.
But I also know you're excited about the new International Association of Franchisees and Dealers, and I understand its convention is coming up in May in Indianapolis, Indiana. So tell us a little bit about it as we lead towards the top of the hour.
Sure. It's May 10th to May 12th. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. It's a very operator-oriented trade show. We've got some really interesting speakers. We've got Justin White, who's going to talk about how you use a newsletter effectively for your local online marketing, permission marketing campaign. We've got David Melton, who's going to come in as many people know in the franchise world. He's a Domino's a franchisee who has, over the last 7 or 8 years, and probably longer, had almost zero turnover amongst his employees and managers. That's, you know, in the pizza industry, that's amazing. He's going to be talking about some of the techniques that he uses to minimize employee turnover. We think that's going to be real important to the QSRs, real important to the hotel people. We've got Steve Chapman coming in talking to us about the Obama health care insurance, how that's going to affect you, as best we know, and some programs that are inexpensive for the operator to get to his employees. We've got a whole host of things. We've got, you can see the convention details up at franchise-info.ca. But it's, I'm really looking forward to it because franchising is such an interesting mix of, you've got, it's the oddest sort of business if you think about it. It is so legally oriented, so legally regulated for people who are making burgers and fixing cars and, you know, providing those other services. There's, you know, almost a real disconnect between what you need to achieve as an operator and what you need to do to understand the FDD and the franchise agreement. So it's a place where I want the, you know, the operators to come and learn, have fun, and the attorneys to learn about more about operations, have some fun too, and also, you know, the be able to tell the operators, you know, here are the services and benefits you should be looking for your association to provide you, because for these following legal reasons, the franchisor can't, won't, or shouldn't provide it to you. I think that will, right, that in the end will help a lot of people. So, plus Steve Allaworth. Go ahead.
I know you have the event listed on LinkedIn events, yeah, and you just mentioned the website. If you would mention it again, so our listeners,
sure,
know where to look for more information and to learn more about the International Association of Franchisees and Dealers.
Sure. The link is www.franchise-info.ca, and it's .ca because the people who own .com own it, aren't doing anything with it, and I'm sure are busy figuring out a price they can sell it to me at after this radio show or convention.
You mentioned also earlier in the show about your newsletter. How can the listeners subscribe to your newsletter?
The easiest way is to go to the site, and there they can, if they want to subscribe, on the front site, front page, wait till the Office Max symbol comes up, hit that, and in return for subscribing, we'll give you a free Office Max discount card. So,
great.
So not, you get paid to read.
Our time together today has run by rather quickly, or so it seems. Thank you for being a guest on Franchise Today. Thank you again for providing the inspiration for the series and helping me kick off the Legal Eagle franchise. You certainly set the stage for the rest of the attorneys in the series, and I'm sure they're going to be gunning for you and try to be better and more. Thanks again.
Sounds good. Good. I hope they do.
Remember, next week I will be joined by Lane Fisher, partner at Fisher Zucker and a member of the IFA Board of Directors. The show should be another exciting segment as we discuss FPRs, or as we know as financial performance representations, a topic that is vitally important in the realm of franchise best practices. Until next week, I'm Paul Segreto. Thanks for listening, and please be safe.